The nature of mystical experience. The path we're following is that of the mystic, and I've described it elsewhere as the straight path, or the way of experiential wisdom. And as indicated in the last session, to pursue such a course, to focus and commit ourselves in this way, leads inevitably to ever-widening vistas of comprehension and hope. We can summarize this as follows. 1. To recognize the universal nature of the mystical experience. 2. To understand the essential unity of all the great religions. 3. To move into the world of non-dualism, that is, where opposites do not exist. And 4. To perceive a new map of reality. All these aspects we shall recognize and examine during this course. Our immediate concern is with the nature of mystical experience. I have yet to discover a more satisfactory definition of mysticism than that given by F.C. Happold, that is, experiential wisdom. Yet there are also reasons why the word experience or experiential needs some qualification, but to this I shall return later. Because of the widespread confusion as to what mysticism is, even in a day when there is, as never before in the Western world, an interest in the mystical path, it is perhaps necessary to begin with a clearing away of some common misconceptions and to say what mysticism is not. Mysticism has nothing whatever to do with the occult. The mystic and the occultist are two different people. It has nothing to do with parapsychological phenomena, such as telepathy, telekinesis, clairvoyance, or precognition. These and other allied subjects are not mystical phenomena. It is true that mystics may possess these special powers, but they are well aware that such powers are not part of, and are to be clearly distinguished from, the path of the mystic. Conversely, those who have travelled furthest along the mystical path may have no such experiences. Visions have nothing to do with the essential nature of mysticism, although they may accompany the mystical path. Of recent years, there have been a number of alleged visions of the Virgin Mary in many different parts of the world. Now, supposing these visions to be authentic, it has to be said that they cannot be described as mystical, nor may the visions of many well-known historical characters be described in this way. For example, Joan of Arc, she may well have been a mystic, but this has nothing to do with her hearing of voices. St. Teresa of Avila frequently had visions, but this is not what she was seeking. Some of these she interpreted as being sent by God to comfort and reassure her. Others, she thought, originated from Satan and were intended to confuse and distract her from the mystical path. St. John of the Cross specifically warns his readers not to seek visions, not to be misled by them, and not to mistake them for the true mystical union. It is of the essence of the mystical consciousness that it is non-sensuous. It is formless, shapeless, colourless, odourless, and soundless. It is for this very reason that I would, wherever possible, avoid using the word experience in relation to what the mystic knows. For when we talk of experience, this is normally equated with intellect and emotions. A vision is to do with visual imagery, having colour and shape. A voice is an auditory image. Both visions and voices are therefore sensuous experiences. The mystical consciousness is void of all sensations, nor does it contain any concepts or thoughts. It is not a sensory, intellectual consciousness. Accordingly, it cannot be described or analyzed in terms of any of the elements of the sensory, intellectual consciousness, for it is of a different order. Mystical consciousness is not of the world of thought. It is not of the emotional world. It is of that dimension we call the spiritual world, a world or dimension which can be touched only by that faculty we call the heart. It is important to remember that although the mystical consciousness is one and the same within all mystics, there is great diversity of expression and interpretation amongst them. We shall examine the reasons for this later. What then is the core or essence of mystical consciousness? The central characteristic is that of a knowledge of the essential unity of all things, a oneness or a one to which neither the senses nor the reason can penetrate. The one who is truly following the mystical path, the path of experiential wisdom, knows in a non-sensual knowing that there is an essential unity behind all creation, and that this unity is centered in the one. Inherent in this is meaning, purpose, hope, indeed all the ingredients of an all-embracing philosophy of life. And here the word knowing is important. What kind of knowing is this? It is that of direct or intuitive cognition. It therefore operates through a faculty other than those belonging to the intellectual or emotional body. Let us look a little more closely at this knowledge. Arthur Stace, the author of the book The Teaching of the Mystics, refers to extrovertive and introvertive mysticism. Extrovertive and introvertive mysticism. The extrovertive mystic he describes as knowing the unity of all things through an outward looking at the external world through the physical senses, through the outward looking at the external world through the physical senses. The introvertive mystic turns inwards and finds the one at the bottom of the self. The introvertive mystic turns inwards and finds the one at the bottom of the self. In my understanding, it is the introvertive path which is the authentic path of the mystic. For what he describes as the extrovertive perception is that which comes with a heightened emotional perception and is therefore an awareness of a soul or psychic rather than a spiritual unity. Let me say that again. In my understanding, it is the introvertive path which is the authentic path of the mystic. For what he describes as the extrovertive perception is that which comes with a heightened emotional perception and is therefore an awareness of a soul or psychic rather than spiritual unity. This is not to dismiss, nor to despise the extroverted perception, but simply to put it into perspective. Indeed, the two understandings may and frequently do coexist within the one individual. The great mystic Meister Eckhart, who lived from 1260 to 1320, wrote as follows: "Here in this experience, all blades of grass, wood, stone, all things are one. What is a man in mere understanding when he sees one thing separated from another? And when is he above mere understanding? When he sees all in all, then a man stands above mere understanding." Here Eckhart is undoubtedly describing the sensory intellectual consciousness, or the extrovertive awareness. Unquestionably, Eckhart, as a true mystic, followed the path described as that of the introvertive mystic. I said earlier that whilst there is only one authentic mystical consciousness, there is a great diversity of explanation on the part of those who share in this common knowledge. An example of this may be seen in the diverse ways in which the one or oneness of which mystics are so profoundly aware is interpreted. Some mystics are content to speak of the one and leave it there, whilst others speak unambiguously of God. Jacob Boehm, who lived from 1575 to 1624, writes in a very similar manner to Eckhart about the unity of grass, trees, and stone, but says they are all God instead of just the one. He writes as follows: "In this light, my spirit saw through all things and into all creatures, and I recognize God in grass and plants." In some cultures, God is perceived as the inner essence of all objects, and this may merge into pantheism, that is, the identifying of God with creation. In Buddhism, the unity is not interpreted as God at all. We come now to another important question in relation to the nature of mysticism, that is, what is its relationship to religion? Traditionally, it has been taken for granted by most writers on mysticism that mystical knowledge is a religious experience. Religious in the sense that it is inextricably bound up with a pattern of dogmatic beliefs. Yet, the two are different. Religion is to do primarily with belief and patterns of belief in relation to God. It defines and categorizes and relates to those things left undefined by mystical awareness. This is something different from what is commonly called spirituality, for spirituality can be defined as godliness. Spirituality may or may not be part of religion, or what passes for religious experience. Mysticism, the mystical experience, is clearly to do with spirituality. Mysticism is not necessarily bound to religion, and this is the thesis of the book The Perennial Philosophy by Aldous Huxley. So far, we have seen that at the heart of mystical knowledge is awareness of the undifferentiated unity, or unity with the source. Strip this knowledge of all intellectual interpretation, such as that which identifies it with God, or with the absolute, or with the essence of creation, and what is left is simply the knowledge of union and unity, and all that follows from this. Let me say this again. strip this knowledge of all intellectual interpretation, such as that which identifies it with God, or with the Absolute, or with the essence of creation, and what is left is simply the knowledge, the intuitive knowledge, of union and unity, and all that follows from this. In the theistic religions of the West, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, this knowledge of unity is interpreted as union with God. But this is an interpretation. It is not the experience or knowledge itself. St. Teresa of Avila, who did not have an analytical mind, spoke simply of union with God. She said nothing of experiencing unity in the sense that Eckhart wrote. It may be said that her interpretation of an identical experience differed because she had a different type of mind. Quite different interpretations of what are clearly the same experience are given within different religions and cultures. Eckhart and the mystic Roesbroek both spoke of their experience of the undifferentiated unity. The undifferentiated unity. And as Christian mystics, they interpreted this in Trinitarian terms. Islamic mystics interpreted the identical experience in terms of the Unitarian God of Islam. As we have seen in Buddhism, the Christian and Islamic God becomes simply the void or nirvana. Buddhist mysticism is undoubtedly at times atheistic, and it is beyond question that there exists an atheistic mysticism. That is, a mystical experience not clothed in any religious garb. Such mysticism is validated by an integrated and fulfilled life, and what Christians call the fruits of the Spirit. Clearly then, whilst experiential wisdom may be classed as spiritual, it is not necessarily, in terms of our definition, contained within a religious framework. Its content may be said to be that of godliness for the believer, and for the non-believer, goodness. It has therefore an ethical content. Indeed, it is validated primarily by its demonstration in a life of godliness or goodness. Mystical understanding in itself does not necessarily have the tendency to make people into Christians, Buddhists, Muslims, Jews, or Hindus. The creedal form within which the path of the mystic is followed will largely depend upon the culture within which the path is discovered. The mystic in a Buddhist country and culture will interpret the inner knowledge in terms of Buddhist beliefs, and the Christian within the terms of Christian theology. On the other hand, the religious skeptic will not necessarily discard his skepticism with regards to religious belief when he begins to follow the journey inward. I have referred to the quality of godliness or goodness by which the mystical path is authenticated. It is sometimes said that mysticism is merely an escape from life, its duties and responsibilities. It must be unequivocally stated that this is never true of those who are authentically on the mystical path. In a recent article, I refer to the Eastern tradition that every country or nation requires at any given time at least 12 righteous men or women if society is not to disintegrate. To concentrate upon beingness within oneself is to be working on the beingness of all those other human beings with whom one has soul links. To concentrate upon beingness within oneself is to be working on the beingness of all those other human beings with whom one has soul links. Furthermore, to be aware of the essential unity at the heart of creation and one's unity with the source is to be holding all creation within plan and purpose. It is to be giving birth to positive and creative thinking within the human race. The true mystics are of such stature that their influence on the affairs of human beings, both individual and corporate, are incalculable. All mystics, and here by mystic I do not mean those who are deemed to have made great progress, but rather all who are on the path, are giving birth to powerful creative energies. The Christian mystics have always emphasized that mystical union with God brings with it an intense and burning love of God, which must needs overflow into the world in the form of love for our fellow humans. Yet good works in this sense are, I suggest, the secondary activity of the mystics. Staithe, to whom I have referred, writes as follows. Since love in the end is the only true source of moral activity, therefore, mysticism is the source from which ethical values ultimately flow. For all selfishness and cruelty and evil result from the separateness of human beings from one another. This separateness breeds egoism and the war of all against all. But in the mystical consciousness, all distinctions disappear, and therefore the distinction between I and you and he and she. This is the mystical and metaphysical basis of love, namely that I and my brother and sister are one, and that therefore their sufferings are my sufferings, their happiness is my happiness. For one who had no touch of the mystical vision, all men would be islands. And in the end, it is possible to say that no man is an island, and that on the contrary, every man or every human being is a part of the main. And it is this very unity which, seen from the mystical perspective, is summed up in the Omega hymn we call Credo. For here we see the historical and the timeless, the personal and the cosmic, brought together in a perfect harmony. It portrays, as the theologians put it, the eternal generation of the Son by the Father. I'm now going to read Credo. There are seven verses, and between each verse there will be a brief pause for reflection. O countenance of Christ, revealed in all creation, unveiled to inward sight, in all beheld, beholding. O Word of God, forever in humans incarnating, uttered in silent depths, begotten and begetting. Christ crucified in us, mortality discarded. Immortal souls, we live, nor death nor hell prevailing. Atoning Christ within, mystery of endless ages, humanity's one self uniting with the Father. Christ rising from the dead, in heart awakened glory, bursting creation's bounds, eternal life free flowing. Ascended, glorious Christ, worlds within worlds transcending, the heaven of heavens contained in you, our soul's true being. O body of the Christ, a universe sustaining, the sacrifice of love, pure source of full salvation.